And welcome back to Coast to Coast. In a moment, we will be talking about the metaphysical world. Scott Allen Roberts joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back, folks. Scott Allen Roberts with us next, a theologian, historian, an author, a public speaker. Scott has attended the Bible College and theological seminaries. He has eventually engaged himself in a 30-year career in advertising, and Scott is the founder of the Paradigm Symposium and currently publisher of Intrepid Magazine as well. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. It's been a couple of years, Scott. Good to have you back.
Hi, George. Hey, it's great to be back.
3 years. 3 years.
It's been 3 years. It doesn't seem like
that. Gosh. I think when you were on with me, we talked about the rise and fall of the Nephilim. We talked about the secret history of reptilians. You were doing all that then, weren't you?
Yes, and I think at the time we had just had the Exodus reality release, so we talked a bit about that as well. It was kind of a big salad of things we talked about.
Well, let's talk about all of them tonight, because this is going to be one of those great metaphysical nights. But tell us, how did you go from being a theologian to an author, which you still do, to an advertising executive?
Oh, boy. Well, I got to tell you, I got my start in Bible college, as you mentioned. Then I went to, you almost said the cemetery, and I said, yeah, you're not far off. I went to a theological seminary. I was in a very conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical background. And I had questions when I was there, and when I would ask those questions of teachers that you grow to trust and you love what they tell you, but as I asked my questions, there were some things that I got answers that were, well, we don't talk about that here, and you're going to make trouble if you bring that up. And I don't mean to paint them in a bad light. They were all very much within the framework of what they believed. But my first questions came when I was looking at the story of the Nephilim in Genesis 6, where it said the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men. And in the Hebrew, of course, it specifically plays that out or spells that out in the biblical passage. It says the sons of God, which was the B'nai HaElohim, came down and intermingled with the daughters of Adam. So there was a stark contrast, Adam being the word for man. And when I would ask that, I said, you told us, you're teaching us that language means something. What does this mean when I'm encountering this in the original language that it was written in? What does that mean when that contrast is there? And I was told that the Nephilim, the sons of God, all that is really the sons of the aristocrats who built the school of the prophets, and they're actually coming down almost literally into the valley and slumming with the valley girls. And I said, really, that's the explanation for that? I said, it seems to me that you're going against what you're teaching us, which is language means something. When there's a contrast between terms, it means something. And I was told, just leave it be. Let's not talk about that.
Don't rock the boat, right?
And so those are the things that started my questioning, and I stayed in ministry for a while. I was a youth pastor for a long time, and alongside of starting to pick up my career in advertising. And I got into advertising as an art director, an illustrator, designer, all of that stuff. And I did that all the way up until, well, it was really 9/11 was the last year that I held a job in advertising. Our advertising agency I was with closed down. I went on and started doing my own stuff after that, freelancing and writing and all of that.
And you've been doing that ever since?
Been doing it ever since.
Good for you. We've got a story, Scott, up on our coasttocoastam.com website. Big story in our highlight reel that says, why the world will end on July 29th. There's a group or a person who has put out a YouTube video purporting that the end of the world is at hand.
Oh.
When you see stuff like that, do you think it's just a bunch of, you know, ridiculous stuff? Or how do you categorize these things?
Well, for me, I look at that kind of thing, and my first reaction is going to be almost like anybody else. You go, oh, really? July 29th? I better hurry and do stuff.
Here we go. We got a couple days left. That's it.
Right. But I don't know. I when it comes from these guys that elevate themselves into positions of being prophets, or they say, God has talked to me, or some beings have talked to me, and by the way, did you know, Juncker, who is the head of the European Union, the president of the European
Union,
he just came out I'm sure you saw this already. He came out a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, and said that he had been conversing with leaders from other planets, and that the world has to get its act together. And when you hear stuff like this, like the prophets of doom, and you hear somebody like that who is, you say, is there a nutter as the president of the European Union, or is there something more to that? So it all makes you pause and ask a question. Is there something coming on the 29th? And most of us deal with those kinds of things the way we did with 2012. It's, we made jokes about it. Remember Y2K? Remember when that happened?
People panicked.
Yeah, there was panic all over. I had a horse ranch at the time.
Oh, did you? Whereabouts? Ranch. Whereabouts?
Wisconsin, western Wisconsin.
I had one in Iliopolis, Illinois.
Nice.
Around 92, 94. 114 acres. Loved it.
No, we didn't have that much. We had 40 acres. It was a small horse ranch. We had 20 horses in and out of that place.
Oh, that's great.
But we had friends calling us all the time as Y2K was approaching and said, you got room out there? Do you have a bunker? Do you have some, you know, because people thought the world was going to end. We've been hearing predictions of the world ending for a long time. When I was a kid in high school, in junior high school, in the church we had our youth pastor used to talk about, back in the 70s, they were talking about, the world looks right for Armageddon. And so we had almost that fear factor that was built into us. And boy, is it going to end? So I hear these things about the 29th. I say, well, talk to me on the 30th, and I'll let you know.
Yeah, and a couple of years ago, we had that leader, Harold Camping, talking about the end of the world coming. People were going to be taken.
Yes.
And, you know, his followers literally emptied their bank accounts and everything, and you know what? We're still here.
Did he run off with the money? I'm curious.
No, he didn't. He died, though.
Oh, that guy. Yes.
He was like 90 years old at the time. No, he didn't run off with the money, but he did die. He passed
and
on.
You know, all of that stuff is, we hear it now. We look at, we tend to gauge our belief in things like that. I think there's a psychological factor that when things look rough in the world around us, we're more willing to consider, at least psychologically, mentally, the probability that the world is coming to an end. Is this really Armageddon coming? Are these the end times? Are we going to see a rapture? Are we going to see things like that happen?
That's right. That's right. So back to this European Union, Jean-Claude Juncker,
yeah,
and his immediate staff says, no, it was a slip of the tongue. He didn't mean to say it that way, even though he did say it. He said,
yes.
He said, many of our leaders that I've talked to from other planets.
Yes.
And how could you slip of the tongue that?
Possible it could have been around the planet. Who knows? But I know that when that came out, there was a lot of talk about it a week ago.
You never know. You never know. Well, let's get into some of the latest work. Let's talk about the Exodus reality for a moment, and then
sure.
I want to talk about reptilians again with you, Scott. Scott Allen Roberts with us, our special guest tonight, for the next couple hours. When you look at, and you've unearthed some history of Moses and the pharaohs, what did you find when you did this?
Well, this has always been, it sounds kind of weird, but when I was a kid, I was first introduced to the Exodus story and a academic view of who the pharaoh may have been when I was in, I think it was 7th or 8th grade. I was 11 or 12 years old. And I was in Sunday school, and boys' Sunday school class, and the teacher gave us all a little project, and he gave me a project. Scotty, I want you to write about the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And I didn't know much about the Bible back then. I was a little kid. And he said, talk to a guy named Chucky Ayling. Is the name he gave me. And so I called up Chucky Ayling as an 11, 12-year-old, and he was he went on to be who I knew in my life as Dr. Charles Ayling. He was the chair of history at the University of Northwestern for 30-plus years. He is presently the president of the Near Middle East Archaeological Society. And he has a very biblical aspect, biblical archaeology. And this is the guy I met in the church foyer after church one day, and he gave me a little litany who he believed was the pharaoh of the Exodus, Amenhotep II, not Ramses II. And he gave me a little story about why it wouldn't be and how the dates worked. And that sparked my interest. And when I was in junior high school, I remember I did a whole comic book in full color illustrated of Moses and the Exodus. And I won a scholarship to the Christian high school for that. And that took me on it. And this has always been an area of study that I enjoyed. And the older I got, it became less the biblical bathrobes and beards and stuff like that, storybook stuff, which is how we relegate some of these stories to biblical legend or spiritual or of the faith stories. And I started trying to look into the facts and say, this was a real guy. I always believed it was a real guy. And the more I looked into it, the more I uncovered that there was history to back that up. Even though every time you would talk about the Bible and history in the Bible, people would kind of poo-poo it. They were around me, oh, that's the Bible. That's a book of faith. You can't trust any of that history. And I said, well, what if we eradicated books of faith from every historical document that we study about ancient culture or ancient personages? I said, we'd have very little left. And even look to Elizabeth I of England, the war with the Protestants and the Catholics, and how many laws and decrees and everything were based on their religion and their faith. And I don't think it was any different in biblical times in those writings. So I did a little study over the years, and that book was really the culmination of that. And my good friend and my business partner, John Ward, he's a British archaeologist that lives and works in Luxor, Egypt, at Gebel El Silsila. We started talking about it, and he had his own theory, which was different from mine, but in the same ballpark, in the dates, in the 18th dynasty, in the families.
Close enough, is that?
About 80 years between our two different theories. And so we wrote this book, The Exodus Reality, and it was a book of examining the two different characters that we put forward. And we had many experiences. We did some traveling over there. And, of course, he lived there, so I went to Egypt, and we traveled for a month all around these different sites and places. And a lot of that, our photo log is in the book of that. There was one guy I remember on Amazon who criticized the book. He says, oh, it looks like two buddies going on a road trip together. And, you know, that's kind of what it was. And we had a great time writing it. And I have a decisive figure that I believe was the Moses of the Bible. And the evidence I use is, a lot of it is speculation. I even say in the book, this is speculative. It's based on circumstantial evidence, but it fits and it works. So I think this might be the guy. And the guy that I think he is was a man named Senenmut. He was a grand vizier underneath the pharaoh Hatshepsut. And Hatshepsut was the female pharaoh in the 18th dynasty. And the way I came to the dating system, if you go to the Bible, there is in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 6, verse 1, it talks about Solomon. Even there's all kinds of controversy whether Solomon existed. But Solomon, the son of David, builds and dedicates the temple in Jerusalem, which, archaeologically speaking, is Temple 1 in Jerusalem. Now you're going to get a lot of controversy on whether or not the temple existed, and all of the controversy around that. But there's a whole, of course, side of that argument that says, yes, it did exist. And here's evidences of it. The Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, the Western Wall of what is now the Mosque of Omar, they say is some of the foundation of Herod's temple. And so the first temple, Temple 1, was built, they believe, around mid-10th century B.C., and they've arrived at a median date of about 966. Now, when you go into the scripture there, 1 Kings 6:1, it says, on the day that Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem, it was the 480th year since the Exodus. And now you look at that figure and you say, that's a pretty round number. It's either very rounded off, or it's a mystical number, or it's a made up number. Who knows? Something times the 12 tribes of Israel X number of years, and so on. But if you do the math, if you have 966 as the median date of the building of that temple, give or take 3 to 7 years in each direction, and you add on that 480 and go backwards, you end up with about 1445, 46 BC. And you'd think it would be as easy then to go to, well, hey, let's go to the chronology of the kings of Egypt. And then you go to those, and you find out there's five of them, and they kind of all overlap each other depending on who believed this guy was a pharaoh or this guy was a co-regent or whatever. But the Oxford, traditional accepted Oxford chronology of the kings of Egypt places Amenhotep II on the throne. And he was the son of Thutmose III, who was the son of Thutmose II, the son of Thutmose I. And Thutmose I had a daughter named Matakare, whose regnal name was Hatshepsut. She married her brother, Thutmose II. He dies early. She takes over with the co-regency with his son of a lesser wife, Thutmose III, who's only about 3 to 6 at the time. And she becomes a glorious pharaoh in the 18th dynasty. And if this is indeed the woman who fits this dating structure, she would have been about 7 to 10 at the year Moses would have been born by the biblical chronology.
Jeez.
And if she found him in the Nile, this woman raised to great power in Egyptian history a man named Senenmut. All we know about Senenmut in Egyptian history, born to commoners, it says, nothing about his parentage. He became a royal household, like the steward in the household.
He was a real person, though.
Real person. And he was the tutor to her daughter, and he ended up having 92 royal titles given to him by Hatshepsut. And even his name was given to him by Hatshepsut. We don't know what his name was before she renamed him, but Senenmut means mother's brother. I, your mother, am raising you or elevating you to the status of the gods with me.
Now, did they have any special mystical powers or anything like that?
Well, according to the priesthood, they did. They were all the pharaoh, of course, was a deity on earth. Do we know if they really had any kind of powers? I think that was most likely on an individual basis, if that existed at all. But Senenmut was also the high priest of Amun, along with the she named him the hereditary crown prince of Egypt. She named him that.
Do they ever, in any of your work, Scott, did you ever uncover how the pyramids might have been built?
Well, I didn't uncover them, but you can see things all over inscriptions in Egypt of how they carved stone, moved stone up and down the river. John and his wife Maria have the big site of Gebel El Silsila, and it's a big quarry site that spans both sides of the Nile. And the sandstone from that site was moved all upriver, downriver, which is north, flowing north to the Mediterranean. And all that stone was used in the grand temples in Luxor, which was Thebes, and it went all up and down the Nile. And you see some inscriptions of how they eradicated the stone or quarried the stone, how they dragged it, and the tracks are all there. You can see all of this stuff. It's all there to experience it.
Stay with us, Scott. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back and talk more with you. I would love to get your take on the Book of Revelation and some of those other areas as well. Scott Allen Roberts with us. His website's all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Indeed, and our special guest, Scott Allen Roberts, as we talk about the Exodus reality. We're also going to get into the secret history of the reptilians and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Scott Allen Roberts with us. Scott, let's talk a little bit about your previous work, The Secret History of the Reptilians.
Sure.
What do you think, or who do you think they were? Did they come down from here? Who were they?
All right. I have some... What I wrote about in my book started out as an examination of the mythos that the appearance of the serpent in almost every religion, every culture, down through the ages as far back as we can go. And I started digging into, I think I said in the book, and I don't remember the number, as I was actually writing the text, I stopped and I went to Google, and I Googled reptilian aliens or something like that.
Or David Icke.
David Icke came up and like 6 million other entries on the Internet. And I started looking through the top 10, and most of them, if memory serves, when I wrote this 3-4 years ago, they were all identical stories with very little difference. Either one plagiarized the other, or they all plagiarized the main source, but nobody named the source. So I couldn't ever find the original source of the text I was reading, but it all talked about reptilian aliens coming from the star system of Draco had come to the Earth, and that there were terrestrial reptilians that, and they got into a war, and one won the other, beat the other, the celestial ones, and that they live now in the background. You start thinking Illuminati, of course, and you think human, but this is behind even that, according to this mythology I'm reading. And I put it in the category of mythology. There's a lot of people that will look at this and say, this is real. I actually had one guy, I was on a radio show once, and a producer from another show came on the air and was taking me to task about saying that I didn't think that there was much to some of the photographs that are out there you see on the internet,
huh,
with the reptilian eyes, you know. And he said, damn it, man, there's reptilians all over the internet. You can see pictures of them everywhere. And I said, you know, I said, I'm a digital artist. I said, I could recreate those in about 2 minutes. I said, that doesn't convince me. I need something deeper than that. And he was almost enraged with me. But my take on the reptilians is that there's something to it. It's like I said, the very first book I did with New Page Books, which was on the Nephilim, you and I were talking, and I said, you know, there is, it seems to me that we can't come up with any solid proof that these things exist. It's not like I can walk over into Washington, D.C. and see that Obama lives in the White House. I can prove that. But what I can't prove is that there were reptilians that were here, that were the basis of early creation. I can go back to the stories of the Anunnaki, the gods of the ancient Mesopotamians. And you can come up with similar stories and origin points, but you can't find a solid line of evidence. And so I have to put that in the category the same way many people put the story of Moses or things in the Bible. They put it in that, well, we don't know if that's real history or not. And so I end up doing that. And in this book, I started off the book by writing about alien reptilians. And the more I got into it, the more the book became a thing that dealt with the psychology of why we need to have these kinds of things to believe in, whether they're real or not. If they're not real, we'll manufacture them. And if they're, you know, if they're real, they're real, and there's usually ways to tell. But I said it's kind of like the existence of God. There are a lot of us who believe he exists, and we see the evidences and so on, but then there are many who say, I need more than that. I need to have something more solid. Show me God drinking Darjeeling on his back patio, and I'll believe you, kind of thing. And so the book that I wrote on the reptilians, there were some people that were disappointed in it because I didn't just come out and state a case saying, yes, I believe they exist, and here is where they are, and here is the exact story. But I recited the mythology of it and said, this mythology has, it's the same mythology. If you go back into ancient times, you go back into the cuneiform texts, you go back into the tale of Atrahasis, you go into all of these things that were Enki and Elil and Enlil and all these gods, you get the basis for the story, but you don't get proof that it exists. And I think to believe that reptilians exist today takes as much faith, if you will, as to believe that God exists today. It's a faith issue because there's no proof for it. And the proofs that we have, George, and I think you know this too, it's like in the paranormal. Everybody can come up, we've got mounds of evidences that things have happened to people. And maybe a small percentage of those are things that actually really happen that there isn't a good explanation for. But does that convince everybody that ghosts exist or the spiritual realm exists? It doesn't. I'm convinced it exists. But it's the same thing with the reptilians. There's evidences, but there's not proofs. And this is what's disturbing about the whole reptilian, if you will, the subculture that's built around it, the belief in it, is that we don't know for sure. And yet we treat it like we know for sure. So we accept it by faith. And so when I look at the whole reptilian story, I say there's something to that. There's something to the DNA. There's something to that story of the DNA. There's something to the bloodline. There's something to the whole Kundalini thing and all the different reptilian elemental things that you see that are in our different spiritualities, our different walks, and our different cultures. And you say there's something to that. That serpent is pervasive. You look even to the biblical story. The serpent is pervasive there. And this was in Nephilim, the book on the Nephilim. I talked about, and I even repeated it in the reptilian book. It talked about the serpent in the garden. And you go back to the languages and ask, who was this guy?
Right.
He's not, according to, I'm sorry, in opposition to the church, the Bible in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, never calls the serpent in the garden Satan or the devil or Lucifer or anything like that. Those attributions were not given to that character in the garden until over 1,000 years later.
But was that character in the garden evil?
Well, there's the big question. Now, here's where I'm going to step out on some limbs. And those of you who are in the faith, and I mean the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, don't go bananas on me here when I say... Is that,
don't attack the messenger, right?
Yeah. Take this as an examination from somebody who asks questions, because I don't know all the answers. Even when I step outside the box of faith, I don't have a lot of answers. But the serpent in the Old Testament, he's called, in the Hebrew tongue, the character in the book of Genesis called Nakash. Nakash means bringer of knowledge, illuminator, bright shining one. Now, I thought maybe that ties a bit into the later descriptions of Lucifer, the bright star of the morning, the bright morning star, the star of the morning, and so on, and the protector of the brightness and the glory of God. Those all tied in. But when you look at that description, he was the bringer of knowledge. I started looking into some Gnostic writings about the serpent, and they talk about how what the serpent did was he brought knowledge to people, and this was the great sin because it went against what the gods wanted at the time. And by gods, and I use that term plurally on purpose, because I believe the Nakash of the Garden of Eden story, the serpent, was none other than one of the Elohim. And Elohim is the name used for God about 3,000 times in the Old Testament. Is one of his names. But the name means both singular and plural at the same time. Elohim, El was the name for God. Him was the Hebrew suffix put on the word to denote plurality. In some schools of thought, rabbinic and evangelical, the plurality simply meant one God of a multitude of majesty and power, is one interpretation. Yet the word Elohim was used as a plurality to talk about the guy... in the writings of the law in the Old Testament, avoid the guy who in his tent sells Elohim made out of wood and iron and bronze and clay. And so Elohim were a collection of little god idols the guy would sell. Here, buy your Elohim here.
Scotty, where does the Antichrist come in with all of this?
Oh, boy. The Antichrist is prophetic, of course, in the writings of John in the book of Revelation. And the Antichrist is the one who will rise up and take power. In short, it kind of went like this. When I learned all this stuff when I was in grade school and junior high school and so on. And a lot. Do you remember George Chick tracts? What those were? Did you ever see those in the 60s or the 70s? Jack Chick put out these little tracts. They were kind of horizontal shaped. They fit in the palm of your hand. Little comic books.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, sure.
And I remember reading all that stuff, and he had stuff about Revelation and the Antichrist. And, of course, we learned about it in eschatology, which was the big word for us when we were kids in school, and the study of end times. And that the Antichrist was going to be somebody who the world looked to as the leader of the world, so to speak. It was almost like a one-world government. Now, of course, when these things were written, the world was a lot smaller than it is now. There wasn't a lot of exploration into the new world at that time, and the whole other side of the world was an unknown to these guys. So it may have been a more limited thing when they're talking about the whole world, just like with the flood, the whole world. Was it regional? Was it all world in biblical terms? So the Antichrist would rise up and become the leader of the world, and all the people would look to him. And he would be, here's the thing that people miss about the Antichrist. They'll go, well, in World War II, Hitler was the Antichrist, or
that's what
Stalin.
That's what we think Nostradamus predicted, right?
Yes. Now, the thing is, the book of John's book of Revelation talks about the Antichrist being somebody who will be able to name his tribe. He's somebody who rises up out of the bloodlines of Israel, and he's able to name his tribe. And so he's somebody that rises up according to the prophet John in the book of Revelation, that is somebody from the ranks of the Jewish people. And he will rise up, and he allows the temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem because it had been destroyed at the time John wrote this by the Romans. And so he will allow that to happen. It was all the whole thing of the rise of the Antichrist and the end times and Armageddon was all about Israel. It was all about the people of Israel, if you look at the book. Now, we've taken it and we've used it and we've left some of its meanings behind, but pulled some of the terms out, and we look at the Armageddon, the Antichrist, and all those. We don't think of the Jewish religion when we think of those, but that's where it was written and that's who it was for. The Jews, the Christians who became Jews, and of course Christianity is just a sect of Judaism, according to a lot of people out there, because Jesus himself was a Jew, and he was a Jewish rabbi. And he was preaching to the Jews, and of course, Christianity sprouted out of that. And so the Antichrist, is he somebody that's alive today? Every great world leader, and by great, I don't necessarily mean good, but every leader that's risen to power that has represented evil in the world has been somebody we've always labeled as, this could be the Antichrist.
This could be that person, yeah.
I mean, there's people who think Obama is the Antichrist. We'll know in about 3 months, you know, excuse me, because he'll be out of office in 3 months. So, and I rather doubt he is.
I doubt that, too.
So, and please, nobody take me seriously on that. That was a bit of lightheartedness there. There are people who have said that to me, though, who believe
that. Although, there are some people out there that thought George Bush was one.
Yeah.
You know, they're out there.
Or Ronald Reagan, or all of those. You know, that's what I mean. There's no way to identify it. What's interesting, though, is in that timeline, it's saying that there is going to be a time where there is a distinct change, and that there is this, what the Bible calls, the 7 years of tribulation on the earth. Some people believe the rapture takes place first, and then that starts. Others believe the rapture happens midway. Otherwise, people believe it's after the 7 years. No matter where you are on that, it talks about the Great Tribulation, and the first 3.5 years are the rise to power of this guy, who the Bible calls, I don't think he's going to have the title, you know, now the Antichrist of the world is going to speak to you via television tonight. I don't think he's going to have that title. This is what John called him. But this is a guy who rises to power. I think great charisma has been associated with the character. He's going to be somebody that draws the world to him. He does a lot of good things for Israel. But then, of course, things turn. So.
Where is the Ark of the Covenant, Scott?
You know, I don't know for sure. It's either in Ethiopia or
in a church. I've heard it's in a church in Ethiopia.
Well, there's a little church, and I do believe that they have a relic there, an ancient artifact is there. I believe they have an old Egyptian bark shrine, which, when you look at the Ark of the Covenant, the way we view it, like in Indiana Jones or the Ten Commandments or things like that, the Ark of the Covenant was based on an Egyptian bark shrine. If you go to Egypt, one of the things when John Ward and I were in Egypt, and I was there for the first time, we'd go to all these tombs and all these temples, and all over the walls, John would say, "What does that look like to you up there, Scotty?" he'd say. And I said, "It looks like the Ark of the Covenant." On a 3,500-year-old wall painting. Huh.
And you're working on a couple new books with John, aren't you?
I am. We're working on one that's The Lost Armies of Cambyses, which speaks about Cambyses, the Persian ruler who sacked Egypt in the 500s and sent his 50,000-man-strong army out to destroy the oasis at Siwa. And they all disappeared, engulfed in a great sandstorm, according to Herodotus, you know, 4th century B.C., historian. And so it's a great historical mystery.
Let me ask you this too, Scott, before the break, and then we're going to come back and take calls with you. You also have investigated the paranormal. Do you find that that field is growing, getting smaller? What's happening there?
Well, I think that that particular field has in a sense become almost a caricature of itself at times. It's a field that kind of eats on its own, so to speak. It's become less and less, while you have your scientific characters there that are really digging for answers, it's become less and less appealing, I think. Well, at least to me, because I see a lot of discord, a lot of things that happen when you have great big communities like that. There's going to be infighting and so on. Everybody's got to have the latest technique, or my technique is better than yours, and so on. So I see that particular community as it's going to implode on itself if it's not careful. It doesn't mean that the topic that they study and the subject matter, that there's nothing to it, but the community tends to, you get communities of people into things, and it tends to ruin things. It's like, hey, let's all believe in this God, and then, okay, so we'll start our own church or our own meeting, and then they all start meeting together, and everybody starts fighting about who's the boss. I think that's kind of what goes on in the paranormal community. No offense to any of my friends in it. And I have had my own paranormal experiences. I almost loathe to use the word, because I think pop culture has taken the meat out of it.
Yes.
And it's made it more a pop cultural thing. And my experiences, are my experiences. I've had things happen to me here. I've had them happen in Egypt. I've had things that have happened to me that I have no way to verify for anybody else other than myself. And they can hear me and say, that's a great story, Scotty. I either believe it or I don't. And for me, I tend to have what I call my BS can when it comes to a lot of stories I hear. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Well, that's kind of healthy to be that kind of skeptical, but
you have to
have an open mind at the same time.
And it's like Michael Shermer,
yep.
You know, who one of your great skeptics out there. He said to himself, he had a paranormal experience himself, and he said that kind of changed things for me. He still is who he is, and he will still question things and question why people believe weird things, which is the title of one of his books.
Let's talk more about this, Scott, when we come back. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines next.